Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. When you hear of the latest school shooter, serial killer, or sex offender, you wonder what was going on in that man's mind? UNM psychology professor Kent Keel has spent his professional career studying the minds of criminals, and now, in a groundbreaking study, has used brain scans to predict who among them will reoffend. Dr. Kent Keel, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Later in the show, I want to get to your really amazing use of brain scans to predict behavior, because I really find that stunning. But first, as a brain scientist who has analyzed and known many violent criminals, what are your thoughts when you hear about the latest sex offender, school shooter, a serial killer?
The first thing that comes to mind when I read about those stories is I wish I could have prevented it. When you hear about somebody who is in the thralls of some sort of mental illness, so they're hearing voices or some sort of delusion, and they go off and they do something really bad, I always wish there might have been some way we could have helped identify that person early, got them some good treatment, and prevented that type of thing from happening. And the same thing goes for even the development of someone we might call a psychopath. We always know that as a child, as a youth, they were different. They were often identified by the school administration as somebody who was getting in trouble, acting out, reacted differently emotionally than the other children. And wouldn't it be nice if we could identify a way of treating them and preventing them from ever developing into the types of individuals that ended up? Mostly I end up seeing people after they've done something bad. I mean, most of our research focuses on those who are already incarcerated, who have already done something really bad, and we try to understand why. And now that we're starting to understand how and why they end up there, where I really want to move in the next stage of my career is helping to understand and developing ways of preventing them from ever becoming like that.
So maybe we should take a step back and just ask, like, what is a psychopath? What are the characteristics of a psychopath?
Sure. So we've been interested, what I mean by we is the human race has been interested in identifying psychopathic traits for a long time. In fact, even in the times of the Old Testament, Moses was the first person who actually wrote about psychopathic traits. And over the course of the 1,000+ years, and in the last 200 years, psychiatry has been very interested in assessing these traits. There's 20 characteristics that's all been distilled down to generally that we study in psychopathy. And those traits are things like they're glib and superficial. They have an inability to appreciate affect, guilt, remorse. They generally have a lack of empathy. They can be very callous. And in addition to those affective traits, they also are pretty impulsive. They don't make good decisions. They're fairly promiscuous. They have a very early start with these traits before the age of 12. Usually gets aggravated or the traits kind of exacerbate themselves in adolescence. And then when we see them as an adult, they kind of have the full manifestation of most of the traits. And so basically an individual has to score high on the majority of those traits to merit a label of psychopath. The test that we use is called the Hare Psychopathy Checklist.
It was developed. I know you studied under Hare.
I did. That's after Dr. Robert Hare. And I specifically went to do my graduate work with him following my undergraduate degree. And Bob Hare was a great mentor to me. He really helped teach me about how to assess these traits, how to reliably try to understand the quantification of them to make sure that they're present in the majority of someone's life or the long periods of their life. And then when you have a trait, when you really find that trait, it turns out it's an incredibly powerful assessment procedure. It predicts recidivism. It predicts treatment outcome. It predicts brain activity. It predicts all these other things. And so it takes a long time to do the assessment, 2 to 4 hours per inmate or per client. But it's something that has a lot of utility in the forensic system.
So I know that because you've done brain scans, you've actually met these people. And I wondered if you could pick out maybe one to tell us about. One I know about because I happened to be living in Chicago, and the name Brian Dugan constantly came up because he did a terrible thing. He raped and murdered a girl.
Actually, three.
And the thing was, at the time he did it, there were already two other people that had been convicted of the same crime. They ended up being exonerated. Then the whole Illinois death penalty went away. So Brian Dugan's name came up over and over again. And so he's sort of a fascinating case.
Well, Brian Dugan, he's a serial killer, active in the early 80s. He raped and murdered two young girls and one adult woman. He also raped many other women. I met Brian some 25 years after the case, and you're correct. As you can imagine, these types of crimes really just mystified the entire community of Naperville, Illinois, mm-hmm. and there was an enormous manhunt to try to find the person who did those crimes. So what happened is over the course of the 25 years, you know, there have been multiple trials and retrials, et cetera. And what happened was after about 25 years of these different trials, Brian pled guilty to the murder. And in the context of the only question was, does he deserve a life or death sentence? And that's what was going to a death qualified jury. And so the defense team contacted me, and they said that the prosecution was going to label Brian a psychopath, and they wanted to know what does that mean, and how do they deal with that label, and how do they deal with the science. And so I flew up, and I taught the attorneys about the science, and I taught the attorneys about what we know about psychopaths, et cetera. And I interviewed Brian, and I talked with him, and I assessed him to double-check to make sure
using
the
hair checklist,
yeah. And, you know, Brian met all the criterion. He was in the 99th percentile. He was a prototypical psychopath by all definitions. And then they said, well—
meaning, like, what were the characteristics that made him that?
Well, Brian has a very profound inability to appreciate the impact his behavior has had on other people. He's very flat affectively. He has no appreciation of empathy, guilt, or remorse for the crimes that he did. He really doesn't
feel
bad.
These terrible things he doesn't think.
He can intellectualize them. He can tell you that, look, I know everybody wants me to say I feel bad for them, but I don't know what that means.
Wow.
It's just like if you have somebody who can't read and you want them to write a book report on Homer or something. You laugh at it, but that's what the psychopath tells you
he's
about.
He's incapable of really appreciating the emotional.
It's an ability. I mean, empathy, for example, we think is truly an ability. Some people are more or less empathic. And, you know, for example, women are generally more empathic than men. And it turns out that within the male spectrum, some of us are really good at being empathic about certain things, and others of us are terrible at it. And Brian is on the lowest end of the scale. I mean, I referred to him once as his emotional intelligence, for example, which is a thing like IQ, but measures your ability to work with emotions and understand emotions and relationships. He was tested on those scales, and he was in the very low level. I mean, almost to the word retarded comes up in the legal system all the time. We don't use that in popular psychology anymore, but he was in the very low range. And the question before the jury was, one of the capital mitigation things they have to try to show is, did Brian suffer from any emotional deficits? And if at the time of the crime he had any emotional abnormalities, that's considered potentially mitigating in Illinois. And they asked me, does his low emotional intelligence and having psychopathy constitute an emotional disorder? And I said, well, yeah, most of my field would say that that's an emotional disorder. And they're profoundly disabled, if you will.
And you were allowed to testify. My understanding is that the first time this sort of testimony had ever been given.
Not about psychopathy, but about fMRI. And so the technique that we used to study Brian's brain, that was apparently the first time it was used in a capital mitigation. To me, it wasn't actually even that novel, given that I've studied thousands of individuals like this. We've published lots of papers. But since it was the first time that that technique was used in court, and it was really only used to try to say that this is the systems of the brain we know are different in Brian, these are the systems we know that are different in most psychopaths that we've studied, and this is the state of the field at the time, the question is, well, did it constitute an emotional disorder? And that was the main question that was put before the jury.
So let me just mention, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have on the show today Dr. Kent Keel. Dr. Keel is an expert in psychopathy, and he has done brain scans, including the one on Brian Dugan. And it sounded to me from what I read that the thrust of your testimony, or at least how the lawyers wanted to use it, was Dugan wasn't really responsible for what he did because he didn't truly appreciate the wrong nature of what he was doing.
Well, the attorneys wanted to make a lot of different interpretations of the data. From my perspective, I agreed with the interpretation that psychopathy is an emotional disorder. They did want to argue that was potentially mitigating. And what was it mitigating for? So the only question was life or death. So another life sentence or the death penalty. And in capital mitigation, it's not about whether or not he's guilty or not. It's really about the level of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, we don't execute individuals in the United States if they have low IQ, right? Atkins v. Virginia, someone who has low IQ is not eligible for the death penalty. Why? Well, they're different. Their brains are different. We don't hold them as responsible. They can still go to prison for life, but we don't execute them. We also don't execute juveniles. In the Roper v. Simmons case, the Supreme Court decided that if you're under 18 or bright line rule, then you're not eligible for the death penalty. Well, why? Because your brain is different, presumably.
Okay, so you could always argue, quote, my brain made me do it. I mean, James Holmes,
sure,
the Colorado shooter,
sure,
is apparently going to change his plea and argue insanity. Jared Loughner, the Arizona shooter. And in some sense, our brains make us do everything, right? So what in essence you have to show is that these brains are so much different than other people's brains that they make them not really appreciate the consequences of what they're doing?
Well, you raised an interesting question. And so a colleague of mine who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, Stephen Morris, he calls that the fundamental psycholegal error, which is that, of course, all behavior comes from the brain. And that really goes to the level of responsibility, not necessarily guilt or innocence. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so since all the behavior comes from the brain, the question is, well, when is the brain different enough that it might be less responsible than someone else? And new neuroscience is showing how different brains can be. And so the question is, you know, are we only going to find people responsible if they are in the normal range? What it really means, you could go back to a case like Hinckley, right, who shot President Reagan.
Yes.
And the Hinckley was the first case in the United States where brain scans were used to support a psychiatric diagnosis of schizophrenia in that case. And it turns out that Hinckley was found not guilty by reason of insanity and sentenced to an insane asylum for the next 25 years based on brain scans and other evidence that he was really mentally ill. Well, I agree with the diagnosis that he had schizophrenia. I agree with the neuroscience that was presented. At the time, it was state-of-the-art data. And the diagnosis was eventually right. I mean, every single resident that went through, psychiatric resident that went through St. Elizabeth Hospital diagnosed him as having schizophrenia. It was like one of the most popular things for them to do there. Hinckley's now been released. He's in the custody of his parents. He served some 27, 28 years in prison. Did we get it right? Or did we get it wrong as a justice system? Well, I think we got the diagnosis right. Now, whether or not having a severe mental illness like that makes you less responsible and you get to go to a secure psychiatric facility versus a standard prison, I mean, that's almost a political question about how you design your legal system.
Well, our legal system says if you don't know right from wrong, then you're not legally responsible for what you did, right? It's a very primitive sort of moral question that's asked.
Right, and I think that so the question is, I mean, coming back to Brian, I think he knew enough about right from wrong that he's going to be found guilty. The only question then at his trial was not guilt or innocence, but level of responsibility. And so that's where these other cases like low IQ and juvenile brain and all those things are potentially relevant. But what those science of those conditions, I mean, being a juvenile isn't a condition, but the science of those different constructs, being an adolescent brain, having a low IQ, other types of things, it really does challenge people's thoughts about what's responsibility and when is someone responsible or not. And psychopathy is very similar to that. I mean, these individuals' brains are very different. As best we can tell, they're different from as early as 6, 7, 8 years old. So if you don't choose your brain and you potentially don't choose the environment that you grew up in, how responsible do we find them for all of the behaviors that they might end up doing?
Let me ask just a few basic questions about psychopathy. First of all, it seems like from what I've read, you're talking about mostly men. There don't seem to be a lot of female, at least in inmates, who are psychopaths.
Right. So just a general background. So about 0.5% of men will meet criterion for the disorder in the normal population.
Out of
one
the whole United States, right.
Well, in the world, yeah. So about 1 in 150.
Uh-huh.
We know that within the prison population worldwide, since these traits that we described earlier, you tend to get yourself in trouble with the legal system if you have high levels of those traits. So psychopaths tend to get themselves into the criminal justice system in any country. And that typically 15 to 30% of individuals in prison, depending on security level, will meet criterion for psychopathy. So only a fraction.
The higher security level, the higher the percentage?
Yeah, usually psychopaths, the higher you go on security level, the higher the proportion of individuals who meet criterion. They've usually done bad things in prison, gotten themselves elevated, or they've committed such bad crimes that they're on a higher security level. And in particular in Canada, where I did a lot of my research originally, the system really did filter people up who into the higher security based on their behaviors. And these traits were very common to be behaviors that got yourself in a higher security level.
Is it a continuum, or is it just you either have it or don't have it, psychopathy?
It's both.
It's both.
It's both. And so I think that within all of us, there's more or less psychopathic traits. And the research clearly shows that the traits are distributed. Some people can have more or less empathy, more or less glib, more or less, you know, lying behavior, more or less these other things. But then something different, I think, happens once you get someone who has the majority of all the traits. And that person is quite different. In fact, if you go to interview these individuals and you meet them and you talk with them for a while, you can tell that they're quite different than somebody who's just a few points below them.
When people really say the eyes, the way they look at you.
Yes, the eyes are definitely different. That's one of the more salient characteristics. It's very difficult to describe what we mean by that when I talk about the eyes, but essentially there's just kind of a disconnection between emotion and what they're saying, and it's almost like they're trying to mimic things. There's definitely a disconnection in the eyes.
So I don't want to waste the whole show and not get to your brain scans, because I think the brain scan part is a fascinating thing. Let me just mention, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and we're very pleased to have on the show today Dr. Kent Keel. And Dr. Keel is the chief researcher, I guess you'd say, of a study of inmates in New Mexico prisons. And why don't you tell us about that study, what you were trying to find out and what you did find out?
The judicial system is tasked every day with making tough decisions about whether or not somebody is going to jump bail, whether or not somebody is going to relapse on parole or probation. And the field has generally developed tools to help parole boards and decision makers, judges, make these types of decisions. Some of those tools actually include measuring things like your age and your education and then things that help to reinforce low recidivism if you're married, if you have a good job, if you get a good social structure when you get out. And these actuarial instruments that we use to predict risk, they're called risk needs assessment or risk assessments. They're usually done before someone gets released to identify what variables might promote risk. Well, one variable that promotes risk is impulsivity. And how do you assess impulsivity? Well, I could give you a self-report questionnaire, have it fill it out, so like, you know, like, well, I always buy stuff at the checkout counter I'm not supposed to. I buy a lot of things I don't need. I often gamble. I might do all these things that you might eventually quantify and say, that's impulsivity. And then I might, as a psychologist, I might give you a bunch of games that measure your behavior. If you make a lot of mistakes, for example, in these games, I might say, well, that's a high impulsive individual. Well, what we did is we went beyond those two measures and we scanned the brains of inmates before they got released while they were doing a task that measured impulsivity. So MRI scans can take beautiful pictures of the brain, but MRI scans can also take beautiful pictures of the working brain.
Now, is that an MRI like the MRIs I've had on, like, for my medical problems?
Yes, it is. Yeah. It's the same type of machine, only it's been super tuned to be able to collect this super fast imaging data to measure, like, how your brain is functioning in real time.
So you're looking right at the brain as the test happens.
Exactly. So the technique is sensitive to changes in blood flow. So just like your muscles use oxygen when they're doing something, so do the neurons in your brain. And we can map out where in your brain things are going on when you're doing something. And in this study, what we did is we measured impulsivity in the brains of inmates. And then we said, well, you score high or you score low. We kind of just took a median split. And what we found was that the brain scan prospectively predicted who recidivated and who didn't.
So what exactly was the test that you gave these?
It's a common technique called a CPT task, continuous performance task. So you're going to see a series of letters presented in quick succession to you. When you saw the letter X, you were supposed to press a button as quickly as you could on a little pad we gave you. And occasionally there was a K that popped up, and you're not supposed to press the button for the K. And if you fail to inhibit that response, that is a measure of impulsivity. And so we studied your brain when you made mistakes in this simple task. It's actually quite a difficult task, and so we get a lot of variability. Some make more mistakes than others. Well, it turns out that if we quantified you based on your brain function, it predicted better than anything else that we collected, and above and beyond all the other actuarial measures like your age and education and all those other things. And in some cases, it was, for nonviolent offending, it was 4.5 times more likely to reoffend if you had low anterior cingulate activity, this area of the brain that measures impulsivity, then high cingulate activity. It was really a big effect, and it was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is a premier journal in our field.
So the idea that psychopaths are impulsive, that was probably something that idea existed when you were in graduate school, right?
Exactly.
But what you did to use brain scans to measure these differences and to predict behavior, that's the novel part, right?
It was, yes. And actually, this study had a wide range of inmates. Those were non-psychopathic, those were in the middle, and those that were high. This was a study of 100 inmates, and we actually found that the level of psychopathy did predict recidivism, but the brain activity that we're talking about right now, that predicted above and beyond their measure of psychopathy. So,
I see.
Yeah, so brain scans were incrementally predictive, above and beyond all the other things we measured, at showing us who was going to recidivate or who wasn't. And that was why it was so exciting. And if you think about it, so I mentioned earlier there's self-report tests and there's behavioral tests. Well, what are those trying to measure? Well, they're trying to capture what's happening inside your brain. And instead what we did is we said, well, we'll just go directly measure with our new machine.
So how do you translate what's going on in somebody's brain that lights up or something? And how do you quantify that into some kind of number?
The technique is referred to as the blood oxygen level dependent signal, BOLD. Well, I can give you a simple example. So hemoglobin with oxygen on it is red. Right? Mm-hmm. And hemoglobin with oxygen that's been removed is dark, right? So that's why you have arterial blood is red and venous blood is dark blue. So right in the area where that changes, that's the MRI signal that we're measuring. And that MRI signal goes to areas that are doing the task that we're showing. So basically what we found was that if you have low activity, if the muscle isn't working normally, the brain muscle, that predicted recidivism. If you had good activity or high activity in that area, it predicted desistance. You didn't commit new crimes.
So are the inmates that your brain scans predict will reoffend, are these all psychopaths?
No, not at all, actually. The study actually only had a few psychopaths in it. And what we found was that, as I mentioned, psychopathy is normally distributed. So there's high, medium, and low. And within that 100 inmates, we had a normal range of psychopathic traits in the prison. What we found that was different was that even after looking and finding that psychopathy or psychopathic traits predicted, brain scans, level of brain activity predicted above and beyond those measures. So we had 100 inmates. We looked at an age predicted, all these other things predicted. And then we said, do brain scans predict above and beyond all of those measures? And
it was brain scans of impulsivity
correct.
Predicted recidivism above and beyond all these other traits.
Exactly. And so that was what was really novel about that. And how well did it do? Well, for all types of recidivism, it was about 2.5 times. So basically, 2/3 of the sample reoffended in the high-risk group with low anterior cingulate activity, whereas only 1/3 actually reoffended in the group that had high anterior cingulate activity. And then when we asked, well, what about just general recidivism, because most of the inmates were in that category, it was 4.5 times more likely. So this is a big effect. I mean, it was a really large effect. And
why not use this to decide whether you give somebody parole?
That's a good question. It's actually very expensive to do that kind of test, but sometimes
you need
it might be worth
$2.5 million
a scanner,
FMRI,
yeah.
Right.
But it's one of those things that the real translational aspect of that research is, what if I could give you a pill that actually brought your anterior cingulate activity up to the normal range? What if it was a behavioral treatment like mindfulness meditation or something that if you do that and you think and you stop and you think a lot and you develop skills, that helps to reduce recidivism? Well, so that's what we're working on right now, as treatments that actually upregulate activity in that system. And then does that upregulation actually predict desistance or not coming back to crime?
So there's a couple of things about all this that I don't quite understand. One of the things I don't quite understand is apparently abuse. Someone could score high on this HARE 20 criteria test and not be a criminal psychopath, not be violent, never be in prison.
It's true.
And it seems like abuse has a fundamental, I guess just what you're saying, abuse makes a fundamental change in the brain when you're young, and that somehow contributes to being a violent psychopath.
Obviously, abuse is a very bad thing for the brain, and it's certainly going to cause things to develop differently. Unfortunately or fortunately, with respect to psychopathy, we know that abuse doesn't appear to be a fundamental component that precipitates psychopathy. There are a number of different etiological hypotheses about psychopathy and how the behavior might manifest, but there hasn't been any really strong evidence that abuse per se actually creates the psychopath. Abuse per se is generally related to the rest of the criminal population in the sense that most mm-hmm. individuals who are in the criminal justice system have often come from poor socioeconomic backgrounds, bad things like that. But the few inmates that we're talking about, again, the few that score very high on this test, they usually come from all walks of life. Around the world, people have shown that abuse doesn't appear to play a causal role in the development of their behavior. And remember that most people who come from bad environments or have been abused, they don't end up in prison. So it's very hard to understand the role that that type of bad environment may play in understanding these types of traits.
Yeah, I have an opposite question, because
sure.
one of your control groups was the non-psychopathic inmates, and you were looking at their impulsivity.
Correct.
And I guess my lay assumption would be these people are probably very impulsive too. Are they more impulsive than the general population?
Yes.
Or how do,
yes.
They are.
Yeah, so we were looking at within that facility, within that population, you might actually find, for example, that the reason why the rest of us haven't reoffended is that we have higher anterior cingulate activity than the guys that didn't reoffend, because we never reoffended, right? And
right.
so the idea there is that there's a gradient or there's a distribution. And individuals who are on the low end make a lot of poor decisions and are impulsive and they get themselves in trouble. And then other people within the prison that we found had higher activity, and that actually helped to protect them from reoffending in the sense it predicted desistance, not coming back to crime. Whereas the rest of the population is likely out here even farther above those two groups, and we never reoffend. We never even offend generally. And so there's likely a spectrum. We were only studying within the inmate population the ability to predict reoffending. We haven't tried to show that this works within the normal population or the non-forensic population.
So there are apparently such things as pro-social psychopaths. And people mention, for example, ruthless businessmen. People characterize them as psychopaths.
So the term means a lot of different things to a lot of people, and so I tend to reserve the term psychopath for those that score very high on the far end of the spectrum. And when you score out that high in the far end of the spectrum, usually the behaviors are associated with poor outcomes, meaning that you don't usually make it through school, you don't usually make a good employee, you usually don't make a good partner, a spouse, or anything like that. And the traits are associated at such high levels with dysfunction in most areas of your life. That's when we call it a disorder. So we could come back to Brian. I could tell you about how bad everything in his life was.
He had abuse as a youth.
He did, but he also had poor relationships with family and friends and siblings, and he had never able to keep a stable job. He never had a stable relationship for any more than 6 months at a time. And so basically the traits were related to impairment in all aspects of his life. But back to the businessman, I mean, these traits are normally distributed. As like we said, some people are more or less empathic. Some people are more or less impulsive. So you may not want to have a boss that scores 20 out of 40. You know, Brian scored 38 out of 40. A boss that scores 20 out of 40, you might think that's the most psychopathic person that you've ever met. And it might be, but I don't call them a psychopath. I would say that they have more levels of those psychopathic traits. But I'll come back to one of my favorite stories is a friend of mine. She's world's expert in predicting recidivism and research. And we were having a nice dinner one night, and she said, look, I don't even want to date somebody who scores 10 out of 40. And you may not want to have a boss that scores 10 out of 40. But sometimes those individuals, they end up in certain jobs and certain things. But again, I think the word psychopath is used as a pejorative label that when you really look carefully, it wouldn't necessarily be the case that someone would be able to be a CEO and actually, you know, have all of those traits. But they might have some. And so that's what I refer to.
Without really intending to, I moved us away from brain scans. And yet brain scans seem to be the in thing in cognitive neuroscience. We're nearing the end of the show, and I'm interested to hear from you. Where do you think brain scans are going in terms of what they're going to be able to tell us and show us about people's conduct?
It's my hope that the brain scans are going to help us understand how individuals, for example, with psychopathy, how they develop. And once we can understand how they develop, we actually can develop interventions to curb them away from that. So to come back to your very first question, you know, when I hear about these tragedies and shooters and schools and other types of atrocities, I always say, I wish I could have found a way to prevent it. And we're actually working with some of the very best facilities in the country, one in particular in Wisconsin, that has shown that if they take children who are on a maximum security violent youth who've already committed multiple felonies and they put them through an intensive treatment program, that treatment program actually reduces violent outcomes by over 50%. Now imagine that. Imagine if we could reduce violence in the United States. Regular violence from everybody who was once a juvenile offender, reduce violence by 50%. That would be a better place to live, wouldn't it? And it turns out that what we're studying is how that treatment program that's been working so well, how the kids' brains change over time. Because if their brains are changing in such a way that it's like increasing activity within that anterior cingulate and helping them control their impulses, control their behavior so they don't act out, well, that's a better thing for everyone, in particular with the kid who went through the treatment program, because he's not likely to get himself in trouble, not likely to commit harm, and then that's the best thing for society. So like I said, I'm a huge proponent of early intervention and early treatment for all of these conditions, and I think the neuroscience helps us understand and helps us develop better ways of developing treatment.
We are going to have to leave it there. I would like to thank my guest today, UNM Professor Ken Keel, and my producer, Joe Green. You've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz. Podcasts of this show are available at KUNM.org. Archives of all my shows are available at StephenSpitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.